Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers, and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It's Friday, November 28th, 2003, 10:04 on the central coast of California, and of course, it's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning on Geek Speak, we await your calls with questions and comments on technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. And of course, if you're net savvy, you're welcome to go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then click on Send a Message. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager of Transmeta, and John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com. En route, I am sure, is Miles Elam, a student of American Literature and computer aficionado. Geeks that are here, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Before we start our before the calls start rolling in, let's do a little bit of news. John, would you start us out for today? What's top on your list of interest?
Top of my list of interest is the U.S. Senate voted Tuesday for the first ever anti-spam bill, capping more than 6 years of failed attempts at making a spam bill. And I think they were just missing the proper acronym. This is the Controlling the Assault of Non-Solicited Pornography and Marketing Act, otherwise known as CAN-SPAM.
Can spam. I wonder if that acronym was made up first before they came up with the...
You know what? You've got to start a bill with a good acronym, or yeah. It just isn't a good bill.
That's right.
It'll give spammers fines up to $2 million for spamming, which is great. This is the third version. This is the third time they tried to pass the actual can spam.
Now, how far has this gone?
It's gone through the Senate, so it's waiting for the Mr. Bill to sign it. Okay. Mr. Bill, Mr. Bush, Mr. George Bush.
You were thinking of I'm Just a Bill, weren't you?
Yeah, I was.
All right. Thank you very much for that, John. I'm looking forward. I just was talking to John before the show about the amount of spam I'm getting, and I've had an email address for a long time. For quite a while, it was on a website like John's currently are, which are bad form. Don't put your email addresses on websites. So in any case, my email at this point, I have one spam filter called Spam Assassin, and that from 1 o'clock last night till this morning, 1 o'clock in the morning this morning, I guess, till now, I received the Spam Assassin caught. I received about 30 messages, and then above that, another 30 that Spam Assassin didn't catch. And I do have a spam filtering on my client with Thunderbird, which is a Mozilla email client, and it caught about 80% to 90% of the spam that actually got through to me. So it's doing pretty well, but about 100 messages a day, and I'm assuming that most people that have had email addresses for a long time get that kind of thing. And keeping your email address off the internet, I always say this on the show, don't put your email address on a website because there's crawlers out there that will actually find them and then add them to spam lists. It's just a matter of time before that happens to you. One way to get away from that is normally with an email address you can get an alias. You get multiple aliases. Your ISP will supply you with, you know, get email addresses for all your members of your family. Well, you can change those addresses over time. So what you can do is set up an email address which is equivalent to your email address. So like John is John at FeltonGames.com is one of his email addresses.
Oh, thanks. Now everybody knows.
So, well, it's on your webpage anyway. It's okay. So what he could do is set up like John December 2003 at FeltonGames.com. And then after, you know, 4 months of that, he can change that address. And theoretically, no one will keep that address because they'll kind of understand that it's a date-based address. That's one way to do it. Let's go on to the next news item, though. Sean, how you doing this morning?
Good.
You did a long drive yesterday down the coast of California, right?
Yeah, down below San Luis Obispo.
So you just got out of KOSP's coverage. How'd that feel? Was it strange to not be covered by KOSP?
I don't know. I had CD coverage all the way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But, you know, actually, we can get the station all the way down to...
Past San Luis Obispo?
What is one of the... I forget the city that we also broadcast in. Further down, on the hill.
San Ardo?
San Ardo. Yeah, but you actually see the broadcast tower on San Ardo from Highway 1.
That's right. That's the main, the 88.9.
So you'd be surprised if we could pick the station up pretty far.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we were into CDs, so just kind of... Well, traffic's not too bad. It wasn't any yesterday, anyway.
Right. Yeah. At least it wasn't a Friday, so...
And last night, if you were coming home between midnight and 2 a.m., wasn't bad at all. Imagine that. So I do have a story here. It's pretty interesting. We've all heard of radio frequency identification tags. A lot of people like to put those in their animals, you know, just in case they're lost. It makes it easier to find them. Or if they're found, it makes it easier to identify them, I suppose. It's probably the better way to put that.
So there's basically a network that you can go and get your animal and fitted with a little insert thing that goes under, their animal, under the skin. And then there's these pickup systems that most pounds have, most animal rescue places have.
Now,
and they identify you as
now,
the owner.
Now, there's a company called Applied Digital Solutions of Palm Beach, Florida, who is offering these for humans.
And why? In case you lose yourself?
Well, what they're hoping is that people will get these chips implanted under their skin, typically in your arm is where it goes. And it's, you know, instead of using a MasterCard or Visa or other major type of, you know, credit.
Is it secure? I mean, type couldn't of someone credit. Just
well,
duplicate you?
That's the thing. So this thing, RFID, these tags are about the size of a grain of sand. They don't have a battery. I guess they're powered by the initial radio signal that's sent to them. That's what powers the response from these. Pretty interesting. It's a 64-bit identifier, so it's supposed to be pretty, you know, as far as encryption goes, pretty sound. So it yields about 18,000 trillion possible values.
Yeah, but that's the different values that each of these can have. So we can have that many people with these things.
Right, right.
But then if you do get scan, you respond with that ID. So
you have your own ID.
Right.
Yes.
So you have a specific number that's like your serial number that's embedded into your arm.
Yes.
And any credit card scanning thing could actually detect you.
Or anybody with a hand radio scanner that just goes, oh, there's their number.
Yeah.
There's
Well, there are some privacy. There's privacy problems, that's
okay.
For sure.
Okay.
Some of those are because they broadcast their ID number, a thief could rig up their own device to intercept it and then rebroadcast the signal to an automatic teller machine. You know, cha-ching. And there's a bunch of other problems that this company is identifying that could be security concerns. What they say is getting this thing implanted, you won't lose your cards or your fob. You know, it can't be stolen from you. But
well, it can. Not
then,
physically stolen.
But then again, yeah, if it is stolen virtually,
it's the same thing.
You don't give the credit card company a call and say, hey, my credit card's been stolen. Could you... cancel that and issue me a new one.
That's a good point. You can.
You would need to go to the surgeon. And
right.
Say, please remove this thing.
It's a good thing to know, though. I mean, someone gets a copy of your number. You think someone gets a copy of your number. You can still report it as a stolen card, even if you still physically have it. But then again, you do have to get it replaced, and surgically replaced in your arm would kind of stink. The other thing about this is it's just plain creepy. I mean, come on, let's be real here.
Hey, it's a lot better than the tattoo on the back of the neck, the barcode.
That's true. So similar.
So ADS is running a special program urging Americans to get chipped. That's what they call it. If you've been chipped, you've gotten one of these RFID tags. The first 100,000 people to sign up will receive a $50 discount. Of course, I have no idea how much the procedure costs.
So people are paying for this.
But the surgery happens under local anesthesia. So,
so wrong. Well, it's a grain of sand. You could theoretically inject it with a large enough needle. I mean...
So people can't wear bumper stickers saying, I've been chipped, or, you know, maybe tattoos in the back of the neck. Chipped.
So wrong. Thank you for that consumerism thing. John, hi.
Speaking of wrong, Apple has this great device called the iPod. It's an MP3 player.
We listened to it on the way here.
Yeah.
Along with doing some wireless detection.
Which we'll talk about in a moment. One of the problems that's been found with the battery in the iPod is it theoretically only lasts 18 months. I've gotten more out of mine, but I've noticed some wear on it.
That's a long battery life. Oh, you mean not per charge, but permanently.
The life of the battery is 18 months.
It's the price, though, that's awesome.
The price for getting the battery replaced is $255.
What?
If you can get an iPod via educational channels, a new iPod is $260-something dollars. So it's cheaper almost to buy a new iPod than it is to get the battery replaced. So two filmmakers created a website called iPod's Dirty Secret.
.com.
I think it's, I believe it's .com. I'll look through this really quick. And they went around and they stenciled on all of the advertisements for iPods they could find the fact that the battery only lasts for 18 months. iPod's unreplaceable battery lasts only 18 months. So they get 100... Yeah, it's iPodDirtySecret.com. They get up to 194... They've had 194,000 people visit this site, and it's become something that people are aware of. So Apple recently announced that there are third-party kits for replacing the battery that you can get for $49, or you can mail it in for Apple to Apple, and now they will replace the battery for only $106. So, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. Two guys with a beef about something took it into their own hands, created a website, create a little video of them doing the stenciling, and here's a result.
And so now, basically, it's going to be cheaper.
And now it is cheaper, yes. Most third-party people who will do it will offer, they have a service that if you send the iPod in, they'll replace the battery for $70, or you can have Apple do it for $106, and you get a 90-day warranty.
Cool. So. Okay. Well, that's good that Apple jumped on that. Probably bad marketing if they hadn't. Thank you for that. Sean?
I know that you're a big fan of Friendster, Lyle.
Yeah, I think Friendster's pretty cool.
It looks like publishers are now targeting those types of sites as potential revenue streams for advertising. So Knight Ridder and the Washington Post are investing $6.3 million in a web venture they have called 6degrees.
Okay. Basically, if you're not familiar with Friendster and services like it, the concept is you build a database of people, you log in, you create an account, and then you say, you define who your friends are, who are people you know, and then they define who they know. And eventually what you have is a large network of the concept of 6 degrees of separation, meaning that every person, the theory is that every person on the planet is connected by 6 different people. So with this service, you actually can see what your tracking is. And so you can do a search. Well, how many people do I know in San Francisco that like to do woodworking? So you do that search, and you find five people that are in San Francisco that are connected to the Friendster network that you happen to know through 6 different friends. So you can see the path of how you know that person. Sometimes it's really close, like sometimes it's through one of your friends, and sometimes it's a long path. But the general theory is that it creates kind of a community around who you know online. And I think it's fascinating.
It's interesting. I never thought about it, but it's easier to find a job if you know somebody.
It definitely is something that you can do on that network. Yeah,
you could probably, if somebody like a producer of a movie or something, were doing a film that you wanted to be involved in, and he was on Friendster, or she,
you'd know somebody.
You could track
somebody
them down, and say, you're a friend of so and so.
Yeah, it's
and I'm an
great
actor.
Service. I would love it if you, John and Sean, you guys both joined up.
I thought it was just a big chat, like a AOL type thing. So now that we're all on, now we chat all day, and I just don't have time for that.
Right.
So I was wondering, it seemed interesting, but I didn't want to do that. But then after sitting down with Miles, and he showed me his Friendster login account and all his friends, and I was reading like your bio, Lyle, and a bunch of other his friends. It's actually quite interesting. And for somebody like Miles, who's single, it's a way for him to meet people. And you can read. I guess they're friends. Friends can post, endorsements. They write up other friends saying how cool they are.
Yeah,
you get an idea
it's
how
nice
these people are.
Also, you can do it for the purpose of finding people to hang out with. Like, if I were now to move to San Francisco for some reason, I'd be able to find friends that I know that have friends that live in San Francisco and go, hey, we both know Didi, that kind of thing.
So this is really just ballooned, and now publishers are starting to see that this is a potential for a larger source of revenue. And I guess what the Washington Post is thinking about doing is posting classified listings, hoping that if you're interested in something, you'll be asking other people. And I don't know. It should be interesting to see. But $13 million in a round of funding has already been invested.
That's a lot to go into Friendster, really, because Friendster is basically the biggest one of those.
Well, the one that they're really targeting is Tribe.net.
Tribe.net, okay.
That seems to be. There's another one called LinkedIn. I don't know the website for that, but it's linked LinkedIn. So those three seem to be the ones that people are targeting. But very interesting. For those of you who are interested in new, cool internet technologies, that looks like the biggest one right now.
Thank you, Sean. John?
I've got news of a new worm out that infected some ATM machines. cash dispensing machines belonging to two financial institutions were shut down because the computer worm Welchia invaded their embedded Windows XP operating systems. Diebold is an Ohio-based company that made the machines, revealed the breach last Tuesday. This apparently happened in August. For those of you who aren't aware, Diebold is the company that makes the voting machines also that they want to start bringing to different places. So I think there's a whole other show there.
I find it fascinating that a cash machine was running Windows.
Windows XP, yeah.
Why would you run Windows XP on a cash machine?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm a Windows user. Sean, you're a Windows user. Is it a secure thing to do? I mean, because think about it from this perspective. A cash machine sits at remote locations. Microsoft comes up with patches for its operating system based on security things at least monthly, if not more frequent than that. So if you've got a remote machine...
They're using it because it's so easy to compromise. No, everything smacks of a conspiracy if you look hard enough.
It does. It's a kick. I'm sure that Diebold did it because it's an easy operating system to do development
it's
with.
It's cheap, right?
You know, it's cheap. It's an easy environment to do development with. You know, you get to work on a machine that's everybody's familiar with as you're developing applications for it. Microsoft has really good support for application development. The whole .NET infrastructure is an entire development network. So I get a lot of why they
use I wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft were involved.
Yeah, they might have said, you know, we'll throw you a lot of money if you start putting cash machines with XP on it.
That's typically how that stuff happens.
And it's interesting, though, that also the cash machine was not only to have Windows on it, but it had to receive the worm somehow, which means it had to be on a public network,
It doesn't say how it did that, but the only damage done by the worm was that it shut the ATM machines down due to the ATM down because of the amount of traffic it generated. Didn't say that it gathered any information, but it points at the fact that these are vulnerable.
Right. We just got a note from Dee Dee over in New York, and she says the MetroCard system for the subway, New York subway system, uses NT4. So I think NT4 is more secure than XP, but in any case, it still is a pretty big network.
A lot of airports do, too.
Really?
Yeah. I remember walking around San Jose Airport, and where you look up to see the arrivals and departures, they'll sometimes have blue screens.
I think it shows that we shouldn't become too reliant upon one operating system for everything, just because of the vulnerabilities involved in it.
Well, great news story. I love it. Thank you very much, John. Okay. Sean?
Yeah, kind of boring, but interesting regardless, nevertheless. ETL sales rose to $13.3 billion.
ETA?
ETL.
ETL.
Instead of retail, we have ETL.
Oh, okay.
Places like FeltonGames.com.
Man, I was unabashed. So $13.3 billion during this quarter compared to $10.5 billion at the same period last year. While this is significant, growth still lags behind growth of several years ago. When the market was growing at a quarterly rate of like 68%.
So maybe this is a sane increase rate.
So, you know, everybody says the industry is doing really well. Sales are up. Yeah, jobs are still down, though.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland and John Tracy. Miles, I'm sure, is on the way. If not, we'll have to pummel him later. The numbers to call in for comments and questions regarding your computers or problems you're having. Phone numbers, 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then click on Send a Message. We'll receive that in our email and respond in that way. Again, the phone number is 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. John? Hi.
Hi. So, this morning we were driving here.
Oh, yes, Max Dumbler.
You had your laptop out. There's a phenomenon called net stumbling, which is there's so many wireless networks in highly populated areas, like a major metropolitan city like San Francisco, that you can pull out your laptop, install a piece of software on it that will allow you to connect to various wireless networks.
As long as you have a wireless card.
As long as you have a wireless card and as long as these networks are open. There's software that allow you to have a fairly continuous net connection as you're going from place to place.
Oh, my God. Last night, driving pretty much around San Luis Obispo, I was having my laptop open, and all of a sudden, my wireless popped up. It says, I have connectivity. No way.
Yeah.
And I kept doing that. I never got through to the internet.
I have an application on my Mac called Max Stumbler, and basically what it is it's a logging system for all Wi-Fi connect things that my airport card to text. So John was driving this morning. I was sitting in his beautiful green Prius, and we were driving down Ocean Street, and I turned it on right at the beginning of Ocean Street, where 17 hits Ocean Street. And we drove down Ocean Street, and then at the bottom of Ocean Street, the end of Ocean Street, took a left on, I think it's East Cliff there, but I never know what that's called, and then all the way to the station on 7th, 8th. And along that way, let's see, I've got... We had this thing dongs every time you pick up a Wi-Fi network. So along Ocean, we had about 10 to 15. And then along the rest of the way, we had another 4 or 5.
You were war driving.
Yes, basically.
That's what they call it.
Yeah, war driving is when you go around and you look for places that have open networks. And we found several of these networks had a strong signal on the road that were open.
At least 5 of them had no WAP, which means wireless encryption protocol, that wasn't enabled. And it was a strong enough signal to surf with. In fact, all these... dongs you could have searched with, but they would have been slower. And the question, of course, are these things connected to the internet? Probably. A lot of these have names like default and you know, just the generic two wire 418, which is a by two wires a type. Pretty impressive actually that there's so many available.
You know, and it's not a bad thing as long as your computer is protected.
Right. That's right.
So if you've got shares that are open to everybody, and you have a wireless network without any security on it, then you're sharing those files with everybody.
That's right. I recently have been setting up a wireless access between my house and my parents' house so that we can share files on our network.
How'd that go?
Oh, man, it's been a big hassle. We're really close. Our homes are actually adjacent properties, and the houses are probably 30 meters from each other, maybe less. And so I have a perfect line of sight.
You got to tell people what you did.
Okay, so I bought a wireless access point. A wireless access point basically connects your Ethernet to a wireless protocol and put that at the very highest point in my house because my parents' property is actually higher than mine.
Yep.
So I put that in the window up there, and it enables the broadcast to happen from there. Anywhere in my house, I have good access. It's an 802.11g, which is compatible with B. Airport Extreme is the G, and Airport is the B. In any case... from my parents' house at that, the 15 feet into the house or 10 feet into the house at that side of the house, you can get access to
no
it.
No kidding.
So it works great. Now, the only problem is the rest of the house, they can't. And they have a desktop computer on the far side of the house. So now,
wait,
I bought another.
Are you just now broadcasting this up to their house and they can get it?
No, I'm broadcasting it
non-directional. Or are you broadcasting it to another wireless device?
Right now, I'm just broadcasting it generic.
Wow,
it's just
amazed.
Yeah.
They can actually get access up there.
Sure. Well, it's close enough. I mean, if you look at from
G
there.
Because I know it's supposed to be more bandwidth, but
it's
the broadcast range is no more than B, right?
I know G has actually the further broadcast
range.
Does
it?
Okay. Yeah. So in any case, from my parents' house, at that corner of the house, we're going to get another thing called a repeater. And that's going to be thing that receives wireless and then retransmits the signal as wireless.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a card for the desktop computer, which is on the other side of the house, that will receive it from like a wireless laptop would. And the general concept will be all in one network. Great feature for allowing to share files. I have a backup server in my house that I'll be copying their like Quicken files over to so that they don't have to do backups on zip disks and such. Great little...
Now your access point, it's different than the repeater you're going to be getting, right?
That's right. Well, the access point is a little different. I looked around for a good G device. And the way I'm buying equipment now, I'll look around and get prices anywhere that are good. And if I'm really in a hurry, I'll go down to like a local electronics store. But what I do first, if I have some time, is I'll go onto Amazon.com and read the reviews that other people have written about the products that I'm interested in. I'll find one that has pretty good reviews. Sometimes you have to weed out somebody that says, "Oh, it's horrible," and then you know it doesn't work with 220 volt power only. And you're like, that doesn't matter to me. So you have to kind of read them through. And lots of times on a popular piece of equipment, there'll be 15 or 20 reviews. So you have a good idea of what people are feeling about it. I read through those. I was looking for one with good range, and that one had a pretty good write up. Also, that it's a D-Link, and the device is able to, if you have two of them, one of them can act as a client. But I'm actually returning that one because it's a $100 client, and a client can actually be a lot less. So I'm returning that device as a client.
So the repeater is going to be a lot less than that?
The repeater is like a $65 repeater, something like that. It's a D-Link product.
This is all G. I can't believe you're spending...
Actually, no, the repeater is not G. The repeater is B. I can't afford to do the G.
Though.
It's too expensive.
Yeah.
Will you later upgrade the repeater, though?
Yeah, I probably will. And what will probably happen is I'll move that router to my parents' home when I actually run Ethernet. And to run Ethernet to the house, I'll have to put pipe underground, and it's a lot of process,
right.
And I don't really feel like
it. But if we come over your place now, we can surf wirelessly.
You can surf on my slow ISDN line. But yes, you can. That's another. It's a good
Some access
subject.
Is better than none at all.
It's a good subject we should get into at some point, and that is that I am paying for my ISDN line through my ISP and my phone company because I can't get DSL. But basically, anybody that has DSL, they pay their ISP. And if I share my access to my next-door neighbor, then my ISP is providing a service to two people but only getting the pay for one. And that's a problem in the long run because ISPs won't get as much clientele, and that will damage ISPs, which means the rates will increase and I'll be stuck with a higher bill.
Yeah.
But we'll probably share my bill. So fortunately enough, I have a good relationship with my ISP, and I'm talking to them about the potential of doing a larger Wi-Fi network in my neighborhood because the houses are actually close enough together, potentially with directional antennas, to do that. And we're going to be doing a Wi-Fi show soon, right, John?
Yes, we are. We've got Alexander from etheric.net. Alexander, if you're listening, I'm terribly sorry. I haven't gotten back to you earlier than this, but he is bringing Wi-Fi over the hill, from over the hill to different places around using... I'm sorry, he's bringing DSL connection via Wi-Fi, where they can't run cables, or running cable would be cost prohibitive. They can just beam the signal up using microwave towers.
If you have questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You're welcome to go online to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then click on Send a Message. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computers and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks Sean Cleveland and John Tracy. We're taking calls all day today. We already have one online waiting for us. This program is supported by a grant from Cruz.io, providing internet services, including DSL and spam filters, for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruz.io membership is available online at cruz.io.com or by calling 459-6301. John?
Speaking of spam tools, Sean Lazar wrote in and said he's got one called Popfile. It's a Bayesian filter, and a Bayesian filter means that you can train it which ones are junk and which ones are not junk, and it'll start remembering that for you and start figuring out which ones are junk for you. It's an open source.
And again, what's it called?
It's called Popfile.
You know, I'm there, actually. This is really interesting.
Popfile?
Yeah, you can get to it at popfile.sourceforge.net. It's an open source product.
So Popfile is an automatic mail classification tool. Once properly set up and trained, it will work in the background of your computer, scanning mail as it arrives and filing it however you wish. You can give it a simple job like separating out junk mail, or a complicated one like filtering mail into a dozen folders.
Wait, but does it work with any email client?
It's not saying that it needs to work with any specific email client, so yeah, any POP email, it looks like.
I wonder if it's the gateway, the mail.
Of course, it probably has to be POP email because you actually download your POP email.
Right.
So this thing probably intercepts it and helps you.
But most people use POP.
Tom, why don't you go ahead and take a chance to try to download that and see if it works on Mac. If you both would like to try to download that, that'd be great while we're doing this. We do have a call already here on GeekSpeak, and if you'd like to join GeekSpeak, you're welcome to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Kevin in Lompico, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have two computers. One's an iMac that has System 10.1 in it. And I have to read a lot of PDF files. And Reader 5 that was in the computer worked fine for a while and then started crashing constantly. So I went to Acrobat's site because I was told that they had an updated version of Reader. I downloaded it, which took me forever because I have a rural phone connection. And then when I went to install it, it demanded a password. I had no idea what they were talking about, so I just threw away all the installers and stuff so that crap wouldn't be left in my computer. And so I'm wondering, why on earth would they demand a password for free software? How do I get around it?
Okay, I don't think they shouldn't. The Reader software from Adobe Acrobat shouldn't require a password. It is possible when you download it, you have to register, give them your name and number and your email address, and then they send you a password at the same time. That's one way to do it. That way they can collect email addresses of people, good email addresses of people that actually downloaded the product. More likely, there was some way of saying disable or demo the program, some way of saying I want the free version, and in reality you downloaded a larger version which you could then upgrade at any time without having downloaded again. That's a possibility.
Yeah, those sites hide the free version.
Repaired version, you know, in order to deal with
what you said. You have Mac OS X.
Yeah.
Well, Mac OS X actually has a program called Preview, and Preview reads Adobe Acrobat files.
Well, it never comes up. Okay. You're saying it's embedded in there somewhere?
Yeah, what you need to do is go ahead and find a PDF. Now, this is a way to not use Adobe's product anymore. The problem with Preview is it doesn't allow you to search text. So that's one of the features that I really like.
In I will eventually be installing Acrobat itself.
Okay. Well, so this is what you want to do for the short term while you don't have an Acrobat client and you want to read PDFs. Go ahead and find your PDF document in a window, in a Finder window, and hold down the Control button. While you're holding down the Control button, click on the file. A little menu will come up. It's a contextual menu. One of the options is Open With. There might be Preview. It might be one of the choices there, but don't choose that. Choose Other. Then go and find Preview, which is inside your Applications folder. Before you've clicked Open With or OK, make sure the checkbox is Always Open With This Application is checked. So again, find a PDF file. This is for Mac OS 10 people and above. Hold down the Control button, click on the file, choose Open With, choose Other as the application, then go search your Applications folder in that dialog until you find Preview. Before you double-click that or select that Preview, there should be a checkbox that says Open With This Always, something of that nature. Check that, open that file, and then from there on out, whenever you open a PDF file, Previewer will be the one that opens it. When you do install Adobe Reader or Acrobat full suite later, it will overwrite that setting and it will again set PDFs to be for that application. But it won't do that until you actually get Adobe Acrobat installed again.
Okay.
Does that help you, Kevin?
We'll see.
Kevin, I live in Lompico as well, and it is a frustrating thing not having good internet access.
Yeah, it's very slow. It took like 2 hours to download
yeah.
a Reader. So,
do you have a laptop or a desktop? A good way to go about this is to just if you've do you have what's your laptop? Is it a newer laptop?
It's an iBook.
Okay, so you might not have a wireless card. Do you know if you have a wireless card on it?
No, I don't. Have
okay, one. There's a lot of free access points now across the county. John here actually lives up near us too in Fountain Mountains, and he has a laptop with wireless connectivity. He runs an online business, and he couldn't really functionally do it from home. So he takes his files on his laptop, goes down to a local coffee shop, and then uploads them from there. So sometimes a Wi-Fi card, even if you're not going to use it at home, allows you to do this kind of thing. You know, go down for half an hour and download the software you need for the day. John, where are you using free internet access right now?
There's two places, Coffee Roasting Company in Felton and Abouche in Scotts Valley. And Abouche has better hot chocolate.
Well, the views expressed on GeekSpeak are not necessarily. So, Kevin, you might want to think about getting a card for your iBook if you do a lot of downloading of files and uploading files.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Good luck, Kevin. Give us a call again or go to geekspeak.org, click on the Geeks, and send a message if you have further problems and dilemmas.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. Kevin from Lompico called us up, and he did that by calling 476-2800, or you can call toll-free if you'd like at 1-800-655-5877. And, of course, if you're online, you're welcome to send us a message about your computer dilemmas, problems, questions, concerns, comments to geekspeak.org. You go there with a web browser. You click on The Geeks and then click on Send a Message. And we do have Lee from Santa Cruz online, too. Lee, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I recently started using my laptop at coffee shops using the Wi-Fi network. But as I understand it, I can't really use encryption at these public spots, right?
Oh, you mean you're... The concept being if you're connected to the network and they don't have WEP enabled
right.
or encryption enabled, then anybody near you can actually access the data that you're transferring, what you're transferring wirelessly, right?
Is that true?
Yes, that is true. So,
okay.
And the thing is, even if you're on a LAN-based connection, if you're on Ethernet or if you're doing a dial-up, other people on that network can do that same thing. So it's not that Wi-Fi is inherently more dangerous in that respect. The only concern is that anybody that's near you can do it. But on a dial-up situation where, you know, you dial up to your ISP and you then get an Internet connection, anybody else that's dialing up to that same network can theoretically access your traffic, and you don't know where they are. So at least when you're in a Wi-Fi network, you know they're kind of close to you if they're taking
yeah.
up your stuff.
If you have hard drive shares, lock them down.
That's a good point. Always
put a password on them.
Always close down your sharing. But
close
Lee, there's a bigger thing here. when I say that any Ethernet connection, anytime you have network access, you are vulnerable to that. What you want to do is always be using secure protocols. And the way you do that, by default, POP, is not secure. IMAP is not secure. But there are secure versions of those two things, and lots of ISPs support them. So what you want to do is see if your POP account or your IMAP account accepts SSL encryption on those accounts. And the protocols are called POP-S and IMAP-S. And one of the things you can do is if you go to your... What kind of machine are you on, Lee?
Using Windows.
Okay. Windows XP or 98?
Yeah.
Or Windows XP. So in Windows, are you using Outlook then?
No, I use a POP-based email.
Okay, which client are you using? Do you know Eudora, Outlook Express?
Eudora.
Okay, so in Eudora, if you go to Settings, Preferences, I'm not sure the actual file name of it, and then you go down to the very bottom of the list on the left-hand side, and there's a row of all these different preferences in Eudora. The very bottom, or second to the bottom, is one called SSL. And if you click SSL on that, on the right-hand side in the preference pane for SSL, or the settings pane for SSL, is going to be your different accounts, probably dominant to your default email address account. There's going to be different things. Enable TLS or TSL for your POP account. And you can click that. And if you do that, then now it's going to enforce, Eudora is going to enforce that kind of connection. And what that basically means is Eudora encrypts all the information, talks to a server that encrypts all the information, and only those two things, no matter what kind of network you're on, can communicate with each other. Therefore, your mail is secure. And you basically enable secure things for any kind of system that you're transferring for secure data on. Now, of course, your ISP might not support it.
Yeah, your ISP has to support it. And you have to get a specific address from your ISP.
So the general...
You're using a public access point, then you can't really do that.
No.
You can. As long as you've got that set up with your ISP, every time you communicate, whether over public or private...
Yeah, but you don't know which ISP you're using. I mean, if I...
Your receiving mail address, your POP account that you're checking, is always the same IP address, or same domain name. And it's always the one that has your mail on it.
But he's right about it when you're sending.
When sending.
Yeah.
When sending, it's possible that your ISP provides what's called SMTP authentication. And SMTP authentication means that you can use one SMTP server anywhere you are. But you're right. Most of the time, if you go to a certain location, depending on what network you're on, you have to use their SMTP server. Is that the concern you have, Lee? Yeah, when you do that, it's open. Your email sending is open. You can also investigate a thing called PGP, or Pretty Good Privacy, which enables you to encrypt your email.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
You can do that, but of course the person that's receiving your email has to have PGP enabled as well.
Right.
What about if you SSH to, like if you're remote accessing a server?
You can pipe SMTP through SSH, but normally that kind of feature is not supported for most home users. Lee, out of curiosity, who's your ISP that actually hosts your mail?
I don't even know.
Okay. Well, go ahead and go when you're at home next, when you figure out who hosts your mail, see if they support IMAP, secure POP, and also secure SMTP, which is the sending mail side. And if they support sending mail authentication, if you enable that, then they'll always receive your mail. They'll always be okay with it. And it's a lot easier to move around different networks.
All right. Thanks for your help.
Thank you, Lee. Of course, the short answer for Lee is, if you're on a Wi-Fi at some store, anybody that's near you can see the traffic you have. That's why if you use secure protocols, even if you are using data being transferred, it's already encrypted before it hits the network. Really a much better way to use the Internet and network.
Or if you're using a work computer and you're using virtual private networking, VPN, you're secure. So that's one thing you don't need to worry about. And I know a lot of companies are starting to go more toward VPN because of that.
Margan in Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak. Margan, you with us?
Oh, yes.
Hi.
Hi, Lyle.
Hi, is this my midwife, Margan?
This is your midwife.
I guess my son's midwife.
That's right.
Hi, Margan. Thank you for calling GeekSpeak. I heard that you listen, and I'm
I do.
Flattered.
It's great. Thanks. And you actually said something that made me decide I should call with a question. The community that I live in is actually Etherneted together. We have one server, and it has a high-speed line at one of the houses, and then we all connect with that one.
Nice.
We were able to do that because we laid conduit down when we built the community.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering, you said about backing up your Quicken files. I'm a novice at all of this, but I wanted to figure out how I could do it without the zip drive.
Okay. Well, when you're closing down Quicken, normally it says, where do you want to back up, right? Is that
no,
what
it doesn't.
Okay. One of the features in Quicken is to go ahead and say backup, and what it will do is make a copy of your file to another location, and it normally makes a different extension at the end of the file. Morgan, are you using a Mac or a PC?
Yeah, a Mac.
Okay. Well, my parents do it this way, and the way that I actually do it for Quicken Backup. When you quit Quicken, the file that actually stores your Quicken information is in the Quicken folder on a PC, but on a Mac, I think it's, depending on what operating system, basically you have to find that file that's the Quicken file.
Mm-hmm.
And once you find that file, what you really just want to do is take a copy of that file and put it somewhere else. Because if you were to reinstall Quicken and you took a copy of that file and put it in that Quicken folder and then double-clicked on that file will then be your account. Your entire thing is one, your entire Quicken account is one file. So all you have to do is make sure you have a copy, a good copy of that at different locations. And you only want to copy it when Quicken's not running. Alternatively, Quicken actually has a backup feature. If you go under, I think, File, the File menu, you can say Backup, and it will make a copy for you in a different location. And then it has a great little thing you can do, Restore, and find that again. So, are you currently putting it on a zip drive?
I have been.
Okay, that's good. So what you want to do, the same way you, when you say, you know, it says Backup to a zip drive, it normally, does it bring up a dialog with a name?
You know, I've never done it that way. I've always just, what I've done is just drag the icon over to the zip drive.
Okay, that's perfect. That's how a lot of people do it. Make sure to do that when the machine is, when the Quicken is off.
Right.
And you drag the file icon, which is normally pretty large.
Right.
So the next thing you want to do, in your community, you need to have some kind of share. And so you enable a share on that server that you all use.
Right.
Do you have a share on that server?
There is a share file.
And is it specifically only for you? Is it for anybody on the network?
It's for anybody on the network in the community.
That's a little dangerous, because if you take your Quicken file and you put it on a share that anybody else can access, that means anyone else can see your finances.
I see.
So you might not want to do that. If you could get a private share on that server, which they might, you know, your neighbors might support that idea, then you could use it as a backup. But the big question is, are they backing up the server? So
Yes, they are.
Okay, yeah. So you might want to talk about the next community meeting, say, you know, let's find private shares for backup. Then we can all put our personal, you know, really dangerous stuff on that share. Then all you have to do is, when you have that share, you should know the name of the share and a password and username that accompany it. You'll connect to that share. Are you running OS 10?
Not yet.
Okay. You go to, after the server set up to be a share, and you probably see this now, you can go to the Finder and then go to the Apple menu and then go down to
Chooser,
and under Choose, we'll click Apple Share,
right,
which is really Server Share,
right,
and it should pop up. When you double-click the server itself, it'll ask you for your username and password. And when you enter that in, it should come up with some choices when they actually set up multiple SharePoints or a connection for everybody.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then it would show up, and you just click on that and say OK, and that little icon will now show up on your desktop, and that will be a Server Share. You open it up, and you can put things in it just like you would a zip drive.
Oh, that's great.
That's how easy it is.
Cool. Oh, that's so great. That makes it easy. Well, great.
Morgan, I'm really thrilled you called us up. Thank you very much for calling.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for listening to me.
Have a great one.
Bye now.
Sean?
Yeah, I want to talk about pop-ups, because we actually have an email from Marvin and Salinas about pop-ups. But first, I wanted to talk about a news story. I know you don't want to hear it. We talked about this last week, actually.
Okay.
It's about IE. Microsoft IE finally putting pop-up blocker in their software. You know, okay, so they're late to the game. But that's not the news. But to give a little background on what pop-ups are, before we get into what the real news is, pop-ups kind of came into vogue during the internet bust. It was a cheap way for publishers and advertisers to get content, advertising content, onto the web, because it didn't take up any real estate on any of the web pages, because these things popped up in their own windows. And they were found to be 13 times more effective than banner ads. So, you know, they're cheaper, more effective. That's why pop-ups are everywhere. Well, with IE finally jumping in and saying, hey, we're putting pop-up blocking into Internet Explorer, now advertisers are a little...
Miffed?
Yeah, they're scared. There are experts and security privacy experts in the industry now who are saying that if Microsoft does this right, it could bring an end to pop-ups. It'll burst the pop-up bubble.
But this is Microsoft, so what's really going to happen?
So who knows where they'll go to next. So you might actually see a decline in pop-ups just because of this. But, you know, like, if they're that effective, that until Microsoft actually proves they know what they're doing and they implement this correctly, I'm sure they're going to be, you know, they're here to stay.
Now, so, of course, this means that people have to upgrade their Internet Explorer to do that.
Yeah, you need to do that, yeah. And everyone still uses Netscape 4.7 or IE 5 or whatever, so... But anyway, Marvin from Salinas says, good morning, geeks. Just tuned in to the tail end of the discussion of pop-ups. And he wants to know more about this invasive phenomenon. Kind of gave you a little explanation there. Now, so he has Windows XP, downloaded Yahoo pop-up blocker, but he says the improvement is minimal. And he wants to know, how can he, you know, what's a good program to eliminate these evil intruders?
Okay.
Mozilla.
Yeah, different web browser. But let's talk about pop-ups for a second. There's one type of pop-up called Windows Message Service. And this doesn't have to do with a web browser. You don't have to have your web browser running at all. And every once in a while, a message will show up. And it looks like a Windows alert, and it only happens on Windows machines. We talked about it a couple weeks ago, how to disable that. Basically, it's a service that allows administrators on your network to notify computers of dilemmas and problems. And you need to turn that service off because now advertisers are actually taking advantage of that feature of Windows. And the way you do that is you go into services and you disable that device. And if you, there's an article on geekspeak.org that talks about how to do that. It's like three shows ago. Just go to shows and look at the archives. And about three shows ago, we had some news section. Maybe we'll write an article about it. In any case, that's kind of the uncommon way pop-ups are happening. And basically, you can disable those. They shouldn't happen that frequently. The next way is called Windows browser pop-ups. And browser pop-ups are basically websites can have HTML, which everyone's heard of, I should think. And I can also have JavaScript enabled in the browser and actually different types of scripting. And that scripting and stuff that's in the page can actually do certain things. And they only have control of some things, mostly web browser-specific stuff. And one of the things they can do is make a new window and load that new window with content. And this is what a pop-up is. Now, pop-ups can also happen when you click a mouse. And normally, good pop-up blockers will allow a mouse click to make a pop-up window happen, but will not allow a loading of a page or an unloading of a page or a timed pop-up to happen. But it really depends on how the blocker is written. Miles, thank you for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
Hey, how's it going?
You look very rested.
Food coma this morning.
I see. Miles, you use Mozilla. We've talked about web browsers for quite a while. And how is its pop-up blocking features?
Basically, what it does is it disables any calls to window.open from the onload event handler. Onload happening whenever a web page finishes loading, it calls a function called window onload, which you can override to be able to run certain things, specific operations. And what it does is basically disable that whenever a call to window.open occurs.
Okay, does it also disable a window, an unload event?
I believe it does, yes.
Okay, but what about a timed thing where you have something at times that opens a window after?
You're still doing a set timeout to call something else. It still has a execution chain that comes from the window.onload event.
So basically, it disables any opening of new windows unless a mouse click occurs.
Right, unless the user actually requested it if a browser event occurs.
Okay, so basically, Mozilla's is really good. I don't know how Yahoo enables this feature.
I've heard that Google has a toolbar for IE that does this
functionality. Yeah, both Yahoo and Google do.
I've heard good things about the Google one.
Okay, so you go to google.com and you're looking for the toolbar, and that will actually add functionality to search from anywhere and also be able to do blocking windows.
Now, the Messenger service, you know if you need that or not, right?
Yeah, the Messenger service
looks like an
alert message. It looks like a pretty intrusive message that pops up.
And to get rid of that, if you're using Windows 2000 or Windows XP, if you go to your Start menu and type Run, and then type services.msc, that brings up all your services that are running in the background. And look for Messenger, and you can turn it off from there.
Great. Thank you for looking that up, Sean. We can take a couple more calls here on GeekSpeak. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And while we're waiting for those calls, any more news, gentlemen?
Sure. I was just reading this one from Slashdot about Microsoft Windows getting into the automotive industry and installing its Windows CE operating system on a variety of cars, including BMW. There's also a link in the same story about the Minister of Thailand, got locked into his BMW because the Windows-based central computer crashed. And the engine stopped, the air conditioning shut down, the doors got locked and the windows wouldn't roll down, so he had to smash the window to get out of his car. He said, and we couldn't breathe in there because the air wouldn't turn on. So there was this old...
Do you remember the old internet joke? That sounds completely fake. I'm sorry.
I'm reading it from ZDNet.com.
Was he actually also trying to erase things outside of his windows with whiteout? I mean, it sounds so wrong.
No, okay. Let's see, that's from CNET, and that was May 16th, so that was a while ago. No, but this is from ZDNet's talking about how Windows is talking to BMW, Honda, Volvo, and others about installing their Windows CE operating system to control various components of the vehicle, which I think is just wrong. I drive a Prius, which is definitely a computer-controlled vehicle.
I could see why they might be interested, because there's a lot of drivers and software, I mean billions, that have been written for x86.
And, yeah.
You know,
but haven't we already...
Got Microsoft, it's less than $10 now for a Windows CE license.
But don't we already have enough distractions when we're driving? We really need a Windows...
Maybe this reduces distractions.
By allowing your car not to start.
Well, no. Instead of picking up a map and trying to follow a map, instead you can have something talking to you that tells you to take a left on the next turn.
I mean, how come I keep ending up at Microsoft?
You don't need to base that on Windows CE. There's a lot of great things out there that do that already.
Yeah, let the record show that I haven't said a word bad about Microsoft all day.
That's me.
Of course,
you've
only been
today.
Here for 30 seconds.
You just said it indirectly.
But I don't know if you folks remember the old... If Microsoft made cars joke.
Oh, yes, right.
You know, your car would suddenly stop, and you would have to turn on your left turn signal.
You'd have to get out and walk around twice and get back in.
And we would just accept that. They would come out with new roads, so you'd have to go buy a new car. you know, it was the old, it's a joke, but here's Windows being installed on cars.
Okay, let's move on.
All right, I got an interesting thing. Just a reminder. Don't open emails that have stuff attached to them. Recently, a message called Mary or regarding Mary comes into as the subject line, and it talks about pornography. And it isn't really pornography, unfortunately. It's really a Trojan horse, and it will get in your computer and take over your computer and start basically allowing other people to use your computer for nefarious reasons. So don't open email attachments from people you don't know, or even from people you know, but don't expect to get an attachment from.
And we got an email from Mike concerning the issue earlier about passwords and installing Acrobat and Mac OS.
Yeah.
He had a good point. It might be possible that the password requested was the admin or single user's password to allow the installer to add files somewhere with restricted permissions.
That's what he was talking about. It was OS 10, right? Yep. Anytime you install an application. Well, who was that that sent it?
So that's Mike. I don't know where...
Mike, thank you so much for suggesting that. Yes.
So now, go into that a little bit more.
Okay, so Kevin and Lompico, if you're still listening, hopefully you are, and anybody else, when you install an application in OS 10, the operating system doesn't want someone that only has access to the machine to install an application. Instead, the concept is... You can't install an application unless you're an administrator of the machine. And the basic idea there is that I can make another account for my son to use the machine on, and I can limit what he can do. And therefore, my son will not be able to install applications on my computer unless I have logged in as my account or give him my password. And that password is called the administrator password. And basically, any time you install an application on OS 10, that should come up.
Yep, and it's the same in Windows.
Same in Windows.
If you make another user in Windows, one has admin access and the second user or other users do not, then it will automatically start doing that too.
Now, by default, the account that you, when you get your OS 10 Macintosh, the account that you set up when you first installed it, that has admin rights. All you have to do is re-enter the password that you're using on that machine. If you have no password, don't enter anything and just say okay, and it will work. If you personally have a password, go ahead and enter it in there, and it will allow you to install the application.
And if
that's the trick.
And you as the admin, or if somebody else had admin access, when they install applications, keep in mind that you will be shown a dialog that says, you know, give permission to use this application to everybody. And you got to make sure you say yes if you want everybody else to have access to that, or they're going to run into the same problem that we ran into earlier.
Great. Sean, thank you for covering that. News stories from any of you other geeks? Gentlemen, Miles, you're not saying much today.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. I just kind of like, you know, woke up in a turkey coma. Just kind of, what's going on? Today's Friday.
So Intel is... announced that they've actually made 65 nanometer static random access memory. That's really small, especially since all the processors out today are 130 nanometer, twice as large. So these are about a billionth of a meter. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter, and this is 0.65 nanometer. Very, very small. And what it does is allows chips to hold more transistors, hold more information, run faster, and run hotter too. So one of the issues is, as you shrink these transistors down, you've got to use new types of metal or techniques to keep the heat down. But hopefully Intel will be coming on the show in the month of December. We're working with them right now, so when we get them on the show, they can talk a bit more about how they're going to use that extra real estate, because there's talk that they're going to put multiple dies like processor dies or processors onto a single die because they have the space to do it now. They could put more memory. Instead of a 512K or a megabyte, you might see processors out there with 5, 10 megabytes on them, or even integrated wireless technologies.
So great.
Should be interesting.
Yeah, should be interesting. December is going to be our little bit of processor in the beginning
of
the
month. Yeah, and we should have AMD on possibly next Friday.
All right. Well, that's good to know. We have a little bit of a story about macOS 10 having a vulnerability that Apple has not actually addressed yet, and the details of the vulnerability are already posted online, this story from the Register. And basically, there's a problem in a flaw in Apple's DHCP client, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. It's the automatic service that gets an IP address from your network. And in general, it is a vulnerability that Apple hasn't addressed yet, and it's not very good. We'll be doing more shows this month, of course. And, John?
Next month.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, next month. That's right.
But he's waving at us like we're supposed to be talking.
I know. You're not talking. Go ahead. Let's see. One more story.
We should have Miles do a story.
We should, shouldn't we?
Tell us something cool that happened this week.
Well, something that happened on my way here. I was in my car listening to Geek Speak, the show that I'm usually a host on. It's really curious hearing it on the other end. I haven't heard that in quite a while. And Lyle was saying for security, you were saying TLS or TSL. Couldn't remember which one. It is, in fact, TLS, Transport Layer Security.
Thank you very much. And that's for IMAP and POP in SMTP.
And I suddenly felt so much more useful
because you
should have been here.
Miles, you're useful every week, along with all of your geeks. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for being on GeekSpeak today.
Our pleasure.
Yep. Happy holidays, everybody.
For those of you that called in, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto, on the web at kosp.org. For GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.